Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is really unique, and you'll see why this is one of the most interesting shows I've ever done. First of all, our guest is Phil Hellmuth, who is well known to millions of people around the world as the Poker Brat, but he is also the author of two books, which we're going to be talking about, and other books as well. He's got a vast menu of things that he has put together to talk about poker and now about how you get through life and how you can make things better for yourself. He has a book called Positivity, and I don't urge people to buy books, but this one I recommend people to read. Positivity. Actually, it's pound. What is that sign? Pound positivity. Okay. At any rate, Phil Hellmuth, With Respect, and we'll be right back. Phil, how are you today?
I am absolutely fabulous.
Well, I know that you must be because I've read about it in your book, and you are the world's greatest poker player, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, it's been a very... I have a very blessed and amazing life.
Well, we're going to be talking about this, but I need to also make some things public to my audience, and that is... You and I are related. We're cousins, at least cousins once removed. Your mom and dad are first cousins. Your dad is a first cousin of mine. We grew up around each other, seeing each other for years, and then didn't see each other for a while. And then when I became an adult and your dad was out of law school and at Wisconsin, we picked up where we left off. And I've been teasing him for years, and he's probably told you to be aware of this, about when I was about 5 or 6 years old, he borrowed one of my Lionel train cars, and I never saw it again. And he later told me, many, many years later, he told me that he gave it to the gypsies as they went down the alley behind the house. Now, he's changed that story, but... I still don't have my Lionel train back. So that's how we get together. Now, the last time I saw you, I think it was that you were about 10 years old in Madison at a Wisconsin football game. But let me start off by saying, tell me about your family, about growing up. What are they like? Tell them about Phil and Lynn and your brothers and sisters.
Yeah, that's right. You made reference to two of my books. One of them came out August 1st, Poker Brat, where I spent a lot of words talking about how I grew up, and that's my autobiography. And then the positivity, the hashtag positivity one, came out February 8th, and it's been nice. Tony Robbins sent out a nice tweet for me. He's on the back cover. Sheryl Sandberg sent something out on Facebook for me. She's on the back cover. Mark Cuban sent something out for me, a really nice tweet, and I've been getting a lot of support from some pretty cool people who like the book. And, in Poker Brat I talk about, I was the oldest of five, and, I struggled, I had ADD, and then I think, when I was 7 years old, David was six, Anne was five, we had a three-year-old, and we had a newborn, so... I think for me, and seeking any amount of normal attention was never going to come my way. As the oldest boy, and then having, you know, three younger sisters. And so at that time, I think I would act out negatively, picking on the kids, just try to get some attention from my parents. You know, one remarkable thing that I've talked about in both Positivity and Poker Brat is the fact there was this sign on our bathroom mirror: you are what you think. You become what you think. What you think becomes reality. Now, imagine seven of us now, my parents, three younger sisters, my brother and I, and, you know, yes, we lived in an, you know, upper middle class neighborhood in a decent house, and but all of us used the same bathroom. And so there was that, you know, that sign on the bathroom mirror that just, you know, would get yellow and wither away. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, about a year and a half would pass, and my mom, you'd look up and there'd be a new one. Same thing. You are what you think.
Whose
you become
idea,
what you think.
Whose idea was that? Was think. that message?
My mom had it up there. And, you know, and I think it was, you know, you look back, I mean, there was a nice article a few years back that talked about kind of the success of the family of my brothers and sisters. My sister, Molly, who's the youngest, is a top 40, was a top 40 under 40 scientist in the world, involved in climate change. She goes to climate conferences, Molly does. And, you know, I mean, she was keynote speaker a couple of times when Al Gore was there, you know. Mm-hmm. And so she really knows her stuff, you know, water engineer. Crazy travel pace. She called me the other day, and it was a Friday, and she said, oh, I just landed from the Dominican Republic. And now we're talking on Friday, and I'm driving my kids up to our ski home in New York. And she said, but on Sunday, I have to go to Rwanda. And I was like, what? I mean, who does that? Who flies home for 2 days, you know, just to be with their kids, and then goes to some far-flung country?
Yeah.
And the governments of these countries hire her. So, you know, she's really involved in trying to kind of make sure that everybody has clean water. And that's Molly.
Mm-hmm. How about
now, Carrie?
Or Carrie, go ahead.
Yeah, Carrie. Carrie is another great one where she it's her life is so twisty and turny. I'll just hit some of the highlights. She got her law degree, and you know, I was making a lot of money. And the oldest, I won the main event when I was 24, so I would support my brothers and sisters with money for law school and college. And she got her degree, and then she said, "I want to race bikes for a living." And that's a tough grind. She was on the tour to Snowy, which is in New Zealand. She was in the tour Digitalia, I'm pronouncing it wrong.
Yeah.
And finally, the U.S. said, hey, we're going to have our own team. And she was scheduled to be on that team. And she was riding the Giro d'Italia and took a net. And she was first or second. And one of the legs of the race took a nasty spill. And, you know, she tells a story about breaking her leg in the mountains of Italy and being in some rickety ambulance for 100, 200 miles.
Yeah.
And just thinking, man, I could have a blood clot. And she loves Italy so much, she went back there, and she's now has a PhD in economics in Italian. And you know, my sister Anne is a Special Olympian who's won gold medals at, you know, the World Games a couple of times, both in swimming. We all grew up swimming and ice skating.
Let me stop you for just a second. Let me just stop you for a second. I've got to tell you something maybe you don't know. And that is, mm-hmm. I was visiting your family. You weren't there. Some 8 or 9 years ago, I was passing through going up to Minneapolis. And Anne was there, and your mom and dad, and Anne and I got talking, and we were a very, very nice kid. And mm-hmm. she came out, she went into her bedroom and came out to the dining room where we were seated, and she gave me one of her gold medals. She's got two
wow.
Special Olympic gold medals. She gave me one of them, and I said, "Anne, I can't take this. This is you earned this." And she said, "No, I want you to have it." And she was so insistent that I took it. I've got it. I'm going to give it back to her, but I put it next to my bed, so You know, I have some swimming things, not for anything as good as you guys, but I will, and there it is with my little medals.
You know what occurs to me, John, is that you had the best of this deal. My dad took a Lionel train away, but then my sister gave you a gold medal.
There you go. That's right. You're absolutely right. But anyway, go ahead. I interrupted you, but I wanted that piece.
No, that's fine. And then that's a fantastic piece to the puzzle. I love to hear that. And so my sister David, excuse me, my brother David, finished law school at the university up at a small college called William Mitchell. He started his own firm eventually. He took over. Someone else just gave him their firm, and now he has Helmuth & Johnson in Minneapolis. I think he has 45 attorneys working for him and a lot of staff to support that. They built their own building from scratch up there, and he's just been absolutely, he loves golf, so he's a member at Hazeltine, where they had the Ryder Cup. And Dave's been a super lawyer in Minneapolis for 12 years in a row, so he's crushing. And I really think that you are what you think, you become what you think becomes reality, helped all five of us to be successful.
Yeah, now your mom was responsible for putting that message up there on the mirror and keep replacing it and replacing it. But she did more than just sticking it up there. She pushed you guys, right? And supported you.
I mean, I'll tell you something, John. You know, there I was, thinking I was going to do something great. And we went in to see a family therapist. Now, the family therapist, let's not misunderstand. That was all about me, and I knew it. So we went to see a family therapist, but really it's what's wrong with PJ, or Phil, as I was called, PJ. So as we enter this guy's thing, and I'm like, God, this is all about me. Because, you know, everybody else seems pretty harmonious. And we enter, and the therapist, and I said, well, you know, he's talking to me now. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to do some great stuff with my life. And he's like, great stuff? There's no evidence to suggest you'll do great stuff. Your grades are average. You're not a good athlete. And my mom just turned on him and said, don't you ever tell him that. Well, that was the end of family therapy with that guy. You know, I mean, she refused to let some guy step on my dreams. And she was wise, because if that message had sunk through, then, you know, maybe I wouldn't, you know, be where I'm at. You know, I've been blessed, you know, and with 14 world championships.
Well, let me stop right there. I'm going to come back and talk to you about your dad in a minute. But when we're not joking when we say that you are the world's greatest poker player, because you've earned that title. And how many titles have you won? And tell us what the World Series of Poker championship is, and the various games and championships you've won. Try to keep it within 2 minutes, because we're going to be coming up to a break.
Okay. All right, we'll do a quick resume stop here.
So tell me about, what do you mean world championships? I know the World Series of Poker I've heard about, but what are we talking about here with you? And try to keep it within this century, listing them all.
Yeah, you know, we have the World Series of Poker, and then, you know, everybody's goal is to win bracelets from the World Series of Poker. Each one of those is considered a world championship. So I have 14 of those, which is number one. There's three guys that have 10. But, you know, I've been having a lot of fun, John, doing a lot of stuff. I've written a New York Times bestseller, Play Poker Like the Pros. I've hosted four or five different TV shows. I do the, even now today, I do the live coverage of the World Series of Poker live on ESPN. That's the only time I can't wear my hat. You know, I actually have to wear a suit. And then, you know, I'm also doing a segment for the World Poker Tour. So, you know, it's been a lot of fun. And I think I'd say that, you know, my wife of 29 years has been very patient with me, especially the first 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about why it is that you obtained this interesting title of the Poker Brat, because there's a story to that, and it's part of your autobiography, but also it's a part of positivity. So we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Phil Hellmuth, who is literally the world's greatest poker player, professional, and has 14 bracelets from the World Series of Poker to begin to sketch why. But we're on With Respect. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Phil Hellmuth, who is the world's greatest poker player, professional, also known at some point as the Poker Brat, but also has got a fascinating life and story to tell about the changes in his life, where he came from, where he's at now, and how he got there, because I think we can all learn from this. This is John Smetanka. Okay, Phil, how did you get this title? And, you know, you won these all these things, trophies. You won the first one, the first championship at age 24, but there was a lot of trying times before that, right?
Yeah, you don't just, I mean, if you're going to be a professional poker player and you're starting with nothing, then, you know, it's not always going to be, I probably had the smoothest ride possible. But I started winning big tournaments, you know, when I was 23, 24, including the main event. And, you know, as oftentimes is the case, it's a lot more difficult to hold on to the money than it is to make it.
Mm.
So that happens all the time. You know, you see swings people up and down. And, you know, I was 24, I won $750,000. Now that was 30 years ago, so you can multiply that times 10 or something, 7.5 million. And I took some reckless chances, and I was very smart though. From that point, I never went broke. I bought a condominium for $200,000. I bought a new Cadillac. I bought a new Porsche. I spent about $250,000 of that on, you know, and so there was no mortgage, fortunately. So then when I did lose the rest of the money and pay taxes and was struggling, at least I had paid for that condo. And then, you know, starts a period of a year or two where it's just, you know, it's not easy and you're just kind of scratching to make ends meet. And so the sudden shock of becoming world champion of poker and becoming kind of a global figure in poker, and then to kind of have like a rough landing, a crash landing, you know, but my friends tell me I'm not going to be a great movie because I didn't do a mountain of cocaine. Mm-hmm. I didn't become an alcoholic. I didn't lose all my money. But there was still a lot of struggle. And then about then I met my wife and, you know, we made it work, but I remember there were quite a few weekends where I would drive up to Escanaba, Michigan.
Oh yeah.
From Madison, Wisconsin, to play poker. And I remember I'd leave on a Wednesday night, and I'd just drive, and after I was done playing Saturday night, I'd just drive straight through back to Madison and sleep in, and somehow was able to pay the bills. The whole time I wasn't a beautiful penthouse condominium, and you have to stop and smell the roses, but at the same time, you know, those bills were coming in every month, and I managed to stay ahead, but
On a grander scale, that's what so many people go through. You're on the grander scale, perhaps, with large dollar amounts, but a lot of people don't. They get their first job and they think, well, now I'm set for life and I can buy everything that I want, I've ever wanted, and they do, and whoops. Somebody's laid off, or the company goes bust, or no one wants to buy the product. And so you know, they've got to face reality. We all do. Everybody, their eyes are bigger than their stomachs, as they say. And so it's not unusual. And we see it in professional athletes.
There you go.
They will live.
Athletes, lottery winners.
Yeah. High, I guess there's a pretty high rate of unhappiness, certainly, but also suicide among lottery winners.
Yeah, I mean, I think the stats show that it's, what is it, almost 90% of those people end up losing that money back. Now, can you imagine people that are, you know, spending $20,000 a year, $30,000 a year, coming into $300 million, and then somehow not having any money 5 years later?
Yep.
And that just seems to be a woeful tale.
Well, now, all right, let's get down to the title Poker Brat, because that relates to your story. And also relates to positivity. So what about this Poker Brat thing?
Yeah, you know, the reason I became a Poker Brat, you know, and you, I couldn't trace this maybe till I was 45 years old, but then all of a sudden it made sense. When I was a kid, okay, I had four younger brothers and sisters who were fabulous, right? They all had great grades. They all played instruments. They were all athletes. Mm-hmm. Everything my mom and dad wanted. And then there was me, who basically had ADD, the grades were not good, I was not a great athlete, and I didn't play any instruments. And so I was not getting positive praise, a lot of positivity from my parents. And so then what does that lead you towards? Well, one thing it leads you towards, I mean, it could lead you to drugs and alcohol, which luckily I stayed away from. But what it did lead me towards in my case is I had to win it every game we played. So I, from a young age, you know, and of course I had the competitive advantage of being 9 when they were 8 and 7 and 5 and 3 or whatever it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that competitive advantage helped me, but I became a master at every game. And so Scrabble, I could beat everybody at Scrabble. I could beat everybody at every game we could imagine. Hearts, spades, any board game, Monopoly, long-term strategies. And if I ever lost one of those games, then what else did I have in my life left? If I were playing my brother at backgammon and he needed double sixes and double fives back-to-back to beat me and he did it, I would throw a tantrum. How in the world could you row double sixes and double fives? Unbelievable. I outplayed you that game. I deserve to win, and had to make it, you know, very public. And so, of course, that translated then to poker, where another game, which I was a quick study and picked up very quickly, and, you know, and then so when I played massive pots, when I was huge favorites and would lose, I would go crazy. How could you do that to me? What were you thinking? You know, so that comes from low self-esteem, and you want people to know that you deserve to win. You want people to know that you are great, or you are good, and, you know, and so that's kind of the transition. Now, unfortunately, here I am 53, and I still act that way half the time. Now, in my regular game, I play with a bunch of, you know, billionaires and kind of the who's who of Silicon Valley. They love it when I lose it. They'll play songs and start dancing, and, you know. and that's the way I like it. I mean, these days when I lose it at the table, I can see everybody has their hands at their mouth. They're laughing behind their... And that's the way I want it to be handled. I don't want to be perceived as Phil's a jerk, Phil's an ass, he's whatever. I don't want to be perceived as that guy. You know, I'm just someone who's passionate. And, you know, and you, and so unfortunately that led towards a poker, a game, a name I gave myself in 1998. I gave myself the name Poker Brat. I figured it worked and I've had that name ever since. I was hoping to switch more to something else, you know, something more regal, a title.
King or Emperor?
Yes, Poker King, or yeah, I mean, that would be nice. I mean, you know, I have all the titles. But basically that never happened. And I'll tell you something else. In 03, 04, 05, the producers of the TV shows, I was on fire for years. And the producer of the shows would be like, Phil, we love you, we love you, we love you, we want you there. And they'd basically say, act yourself. And I'd be like, all right, I want to hear them spell it out.
Mm-hmm.
I know what they're going to say. And I'd be, what do you mean exactly? I'd play dumb. And they'd say, you know, be yourself. And then finally they'd admit, we want you to be the Poker Brat. We want you to lose it. I mean, it's great television. and then I'd start laughing. You know, here the thing I was trying to get rid of the most is the thing that the television wanted the most.
Yeah.
And I never could quite shake it. What did surprise me is I thought by 2007 everybody would know that I was kind of the good guy at poker. Someone who's never cheated on his wife in 29 years. Someone who doesn't do drugs. Someone who is loyal. Someone who is a good guy. And everybody in poker knows that about me. But the public is confused to this day. So, now, I suppose I made a lot more money because I'm viewed as the poker brat or the bad guy in some ways. But not the reputation and image I sought.
When you won your first main table, or whatever it's called. I watch it on television.
Main event,
sorry. When I watch that, I'm fascinated by it because I know I could never do it. And just like when I used to play baseball, that I used to know I could play, but now at my age, I'm not a starting pitcher anymore. But I do watch it, and I watch it for the characters as well as the action. And so I put together, I want you to think about what I'm about to say and tell me if I'm right. It seems to me that being a successful poker player or gambler, like in many other areas of life, requires four things. Number one, it requires that you get the cards. If you get twos and threes and everybody else gets tens and jacks and whatnot, that's not a good thing. Second thing is you have to know and you have to understand your opponents. And the third is you've got to understand the context in which you are operating. In that case, it's the main event or it's this television event and people around a table and there's much tension and whatnot. And finally, there's you. And by you, I mean, you've got to have control and know, you've got to have something going for you. Whether it seems to me there's the ability to understand your opponents and the cards, or your ability to intuit to what other people have in their hands. Something like that. Have I sketched out at least some of the aspects of being a good poker player?
Yes. I mean, the luck thing, of course, is irrelevant because over time, if you want to win big on a particular day or you want to win a tournament over a 2 or 3 day period, then you need some luck. But obviously, after a couple of years, 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years, the luck all kind of balances out, right?
Okay.
But discipline and reading abilities are two of the things you were kind of getting to, I think.
Yes, that's right.
And so the discipline is super important. I just happen to be a very disciplined person, and that's reflected in the fact away from the table that I've never cheated on my wife. I'm very proud of that, and she says I talk about it too much, and she's probably right. But I'm proud of that, and when you become rich and famous and you have a lot of opportunities, and I've been dealing with the fame and fortune stuff since at least 2003. In poker, I became famous in 1989. And so I'm proud of that. I live my life at a very high level ethically and a very high moral level. And people are like, what do you mean you're a professional poker player? Well, okay. Yes, I am a professional poker player, but I'm proud of the person that I am.
Phil, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a bit about the one person we haven't mentioned so far, which is your dad, because he had reading your books, he had a big effect on your life, sometimes happy and other times uncomfortable. And since I know your mom and dad very well, I'm interested in your description of how he, as a person, affected you, and what you learned from him, and what you would like to see changed, I suppose. Although I've watched him on television standing behind you in the crowd and cheering you. So I know that that this is an interesting facet. There was an interesting facet of your life that it was not pleasant, but it seems to have worked out. But at any rate, we're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we're talking to Phil Hellmuth. He gave himself the title of the poker brat, and now he can't get rid of it, but he is the world's greatest poker player. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Phil Hellmuth, who is, by achievement, the world's greatest poker player. And he knows it. But he also is many other things. And he's a member of a family, and he's grew up and thrived eventually, and has set his own course in his own life. So, Phil, how about your dad? How about Phil Sr.? What kind of an effect did he have on you?
So my dad was, you know, now you know his dad.
Yes, I do.
And that was George.
Yes.
And George was a real disciplinarian, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes, he was.
You know, George was a world-famous heart surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
He won the American Heart Association Surgeon of the Year in, like, 1973. I'm probably getting the year wrong, but I think 73. And George Hellmuth. And so my father was raised kind of more with an iron fist, I'd say. And so then, of course, that translates to the oldest. Now, particularly when the oldest is not getting the grades that you want, is not doing athletically what you want, not even close, and it has really no plays, no instruments as well, then I think there was bound to be some conflict because my father, a disciplinarian, and then the oldest of five, and I'm just not leading down the path that he wants. He wants me to lead. He wanted me to get good grades and do all these things and kind of, like, you know, teach the other kids. And so that just didn't work out. And so I think, you know, my father and I, he was always honest and fair. And, you know, fair is a big thing. And I think we struggled a lot when I hit my junior year, my sophomore year in high school, my junior year in high school, when I just wasn't getting grades. And, you know, and I wasn't going to back down either. I'm a very strong person. And so I remember, you know, him and I kind of arguing vociferously, yelling at each other, and all my four younger brothers and sisters and my mom scattering into the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed to happen a lot. And, you know, and so, but I always respected my father and loved my father. And so, you know, and so when he, I knew he was doing nothing but pulling for me. So then, you know, when I started, somehow he helped me get into the University of Wisconsin. I had to get one good semester at Madison West High School. I pulled it off, made the University of Wisconsin. I needed one good semester there to keep myself in. I pulled off my 3.0, and then I relaxed, you know, one good semester, you know,
yeah.
And I found poker, and I think my father and I became very much at odds again when I dropped out of school 3 years later to be a professional poker player, and him just going, what is this? You know, my dad with a PhD, my dad with a JD, my dad with an MBA, and working at the University of Wisconsin, and here I'm dropping out of school. I mean, it was... there was a lot of battling going on, and I was very strategic, and I would come home, and my father would give me some guff, and I'd say, hey, I'm leaving. I'm not coming back for a month. I'd come back a month later, and I'd say, Dad, if you're going to start and end me, I'm leaving for 2 months this time. He'd start. I'd say, all right, I'll see you in 2 months. And I'd come back and say, all right, if you start giving me guff again, I'm leaving for another 2 months. You won't see or hear from me. And finally, after 10 months, I think finally he stopped. And then by then things started kind of happening for me. All of a sudden I was 21 and paid off all my student loans. And I was 22 when I was playing poker professionally on the road. And, I was 23 and I won couple hundred thousand dollars in some tournaments. You know, maybe I was just 24 at the time, and I won a major tournament and another second back to back, four glorious days in LA, and I came home with $230,000, and I started helping my brothers and sisters, law school, with college, you know, because I believed in education, even though I didn't finish. And then I took my mom anywhere in the world she wanted to go. She wanted to go to Florida and swim with dolphins and study shamanism. Okay, we went. Spent a week down there. And then I told my dad, I'll bring you anywhere in the world you want to go. Please choose New Zealand or Australia. You know? And he didn't want to choose that. And he's like, I want to watch you play the main event in 1989 in May. And I'm like, oh, that's a bad choice. I'm going to have to ignore you. And I said, let me ask you about it in 2 months. And, you know, I wasn't staying away for 2 months. We were getting along really well by then. 2 months later, where do you want to go? I want to go to the main event. Oh, no, that's a bad idea. I'm going to have to ignore you for 4 days. Well, finally, at Christmas of that year, 6 months before the main event, I asked him again, and he said, all right. And I said, all right, if I win it, I'm going to buy you a new car. And so he flew out there. And there was this little company called ESPN, no one had ever heard of, 1989, for yeah. God's sakes. And ESPN's filming it. And I got heads up against Johnny Chan, who had won it in 87 and 88. He was going for a remarkable three-peat. But I was also going for history, youngest champion ever. And there was my dad, and I couldn't let him down. You know, I mean, my dad's been there. He only comes out for a week every year at the series. He's probably seen 10 of my 14 bracelets. There's something there about you have to perform your best in front of your own father, you know? And so it's no accident that that's the case. And I won it. And it's $750,000 for first. And there were stands set up. And ESPN was filming it. And, you know, I just remember my father coming running up the aisle behind me. I had forbid him to be in my view for 4 days because I figured if I saw him, I'd freak out.
Yeah.
But we had cut these negotiations in advance, but there it was over now. And he's running up the aisle. And of course, there's $1 million in cash on the table in 1989. So the security guard stopped. I wave him through. And I just remember, you know, within 1 minute of winning it, just giving my dad a hug and just thinking this is the greatest day of my life. I've won the main event, which was a lifetime goal. By then, I'd written lifetime goals, which I talk about in my book, Positivity. And to have him there to witness it, wow, what a great moment. We went out and spent a couple $1,000s on a nice dinner. And then, but just having him there, and then that changed everything. Anything that we had ever had that was icy was now hot the rest of my life. So my mother and I have had a perfect relationship for 30 years. I bought him a new Mercedes. I married a doctor. My wife's a doctor. Yeah. And so the letters were all taken care of. And she went to the University of Wisconsin. Check, check, check. And then, of course, you couldn't have predicted this, but who went to Oxford to speak at, you know, the memorial, the union there? Me. You know,
now that is the Oxford Union is a place where the greatest characters, and I say that in the finest sense, present topics. Jerry Falwell, for example, spoke there. I'm sure Winston Churchill and so on.
Churchill did.
Great.
Clinton, every U.S. president.
Yeah. I want
to. Yep, they've all spoken there. And so for me to speak there, I knew it was a big idea, but only because of my father. And my wife is like, oh, my God, but she was a medical student. But me as a poker player, a little more disconnected from the idea of speaking there and not kind of the importance and fun of it. But, yeah, so, I mean, you know, I checked some boxes for my father, and, you know, now I'm safe for life with him.
Well, I'm gonna break in right now and tell you something I don't know if you ever heard. I told your dad and mom this recently when I met with him. But I had a certain person, a young man, who for various reasons came across my eyesight And I started off by saying this to this kid, you know, you are a risk taker. You know, you're a risk taker. You know, you got to control that. You know, your behavior, and by the way, the risks he was taking were not just playing poker. At any rate, he said, he got kind of hostile. And he says, hey, I'm not listening to you. You're not my father. I don't have to listen to you. And I said, no, you don't have to listen to me. No, not at all. I said, but you got to control this risk taking. He said, yeah, I'm a risk taker. And you know what I do? What's that? I play poker at the casino. I said, really? And he said, yeah. I said, are you any good? He said, am I any good? Do you know that last year I made $20,000 at the casino? And I said, well, now, you don't know this about me, but I'm kind of a naive guy. And so I said to him, really? Oh, you know what? I've got this cousin of mine who is, he makes money at the casinos. Yeah, he gets a snarl to his face, and he's, yeah, but does he win $20,000 a year? And I said, well, actually, I think he's won more than that. And he said, well, who is your cousin? I said, well, his name is P.J. Hellmuth. Phil Hellmuth is your cousin? Yeah, that's right. And he said, oh, my God, he's my idol. I read all of his books. I've listened to all of his, watched his DVDs. He's wonderful. He's my God. I wait until I tell the guys that I know Phil Hellmuth's cousin. So this, I told your dad and mom, they get an appreciation out of that. I don't know if they ever mentioned that to you. But now I want to talk quite a bit.
You know, it's nice. I do have some I have some amazing fans, and they're very passionate about me and what I've done, and I really appreciate that. And I, you know, people come up to me, and it used to be almost every day, and they'd say, you're my idol. You're who I aspire to be in life. And, of course, I didn't deal with it well. I mean, even until the last 3 or 4 years, even until I was in my late 40s. Not that I wasn't the nicest guy I could ever be, but, you know, it gets to your ego, and then it has some negative consequences. And mm-hmm. So I think the last 2 or 3 years, I've been a lot better at dealing with that, and I've been able to talk to people like Michael Jordan and Elon Musk, and I've had at Tiger Woods, and you know, we'll sit down and drink for a couple of hours or smoke cigars Elon just ignores praise. And so it's interesting to see how they deal with it. And then I try to take my cues from that.
All right. We've talked a lot about you and your history and your family and your poker playing. We have not talked yet about positivity, because now we're going to talk about how it's all come together in a short but very interesting book that, as I said when I first started, I recommend to people. It's not long, but it's powerful. Tell me, how did you come up with this positivity, this book?
So the title of the book is called Hashtag Positivity. So on Twitter, so I knew I had to write this book starting in 02, 03. In 01, a gentleman came up to me and said, I wouldn't be alive without you. And I'm like, huh? And he's like, I was in a coma, and in order to keep myself alive, I imagined playing heads up against you. And so it's just a very weird thing. And at that point, I realized how inspiring I could be if I became the best in the world at poker. I know that when I watch Tiger Woods play golf and he hits the ball to 2 feet all the time, and I'm just like, oh, my God, how did he do that? I'm inspired. When I watch Michael Jordan, you know, just do what he did for all those years and just put out all that energy, you know, and these days, you know, I'm friends with some of the guys in the NBA, and one of them who I really like a lot is Draymond Green, and he's putting out that same defensive energy, just always running and working, you know, and so you watch the greatest in the world do what they do that not everybody else can do. And so as that kind of then morphed into televised poker and people saying, it was impossible you could fold that hand. How could you fold that hand? How could you make that move? How could you call that guy? And you start doing things that other people in the world aren't going to be able to do. And, you know, that's just the reading ability of someone betting all their chips and me just calling $1 million with bottom pair or ace high. And just people at home watching it and going, even the other pros going, what in the world just happened? How did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you have to make these amazing moves if you want to win tournaments. There's just sometimes you're in bad spots. And sometimes, and then, you know, and you have to be able to fold. And then sometimes someone else puts a lot of heat on you and you have to make an amazing call. And so I'm losing track of even what I'm talking about now.
We'll now take a break. And when we come back, I want you to kind of walk through the chapters, which each of them are messages that you want to convey to people who read your book and you know, may want to either model themselves on you or at least learn something from you. So we're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we're talking to Phil Hellmuth, the world's greatest poker player and a nice guy in real life. This is, I say, John Smetanka on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Phil Hellmuth, a.k.a. the Poker Brat, a title he came up with. He earned it, but he also came up with it himself, but also a decent person and a driven person to succeed. And he writes about lessons he learned in hashtag positivity. So, Phil, walk through this. What lessons did you put into this book?
Well, you know, as we were saying before the break, before I got a little confused, basically, I figured I can be very inspirational, and I thought, well, if you're going to be inspirational, why not help a lot of people out? And then I thought, well, if you're going to help a lot of people out, I had my mind on all of these different lessons that I've learned. One of them was when I moved to the Bay Area, everybody successful kept telling me I was in the right place at the right time. I heard it over and over again. And so I thought, wow, there's something there. And besides just modesty. And so, you know, and I could just pry a little deeper, and it wasn't just modesty. I kind of came to the conclusion after 10 years, there were always all of us in the right place at the right time, but most people don't know how to look for it. And so, you know, I talk about, you know, there's a door in front of all of us, and most people don't know how to take that door. And, you know, to segue, to do it quickly, I'll do a quick example about that. Two guys are sitting at home, and one guy lays up the perfect sports bar to his wife and kids, and then says, Martha, please pass the piece. He's done with the idea. The other guy, same wife, same kids, same number, lays out an amazing idea. The difference is this. He gets up the next day and he says, you know what, I'm going to go buy my favorite sports bar and take a look and talk to the owner. He has opened a door. Behind that door, you know, anybody could name six other doors. One could be, you know, that the owner ends up selling the place. Another could be the owner helps him finance his place. Another could be that the guy just gives up on the idea because he realizes he has to work 60 hours a week. The point is, he's opened a door, and there's four more doors or eight more doors behind that. Then you open another door. Most people just say, Martha, please pass the peas.
All right. The mirror. Let's go back to the mirror that your mom decorated with a sign. Tell us that again. What was on that sign?
Well, that was you are what you think you become. What you think becomes reality. And so, you know, way back in 1988, I was, you know, I had a particular a day where, you know, I'm not a drug guy, I'm not a big drinker, but it was noon, and we were playing poker, and the games were so small that I had $20,000 in the bank. What was I trying to make, $300? So I got bored, and I pulled a couple guys with me, and we smoked some pot, and we started drinking. We went to this bar, and we started playing pool for $10 or $20 a game, and I'm like, what is this life? What are you doing? You know, and so I went and I opened the door. I'd been dark all day, cloudy, muggy day. You know the type in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was snow on the ground, and I opened that door up, and somehow the sun came out, had come out just then, and it was hitting all the snow and hitting like me, like, and of course I'd been in a dark, dingy place, and boom, it was like this light came into my life, and it was like that. You know, a song, many days go by, like a Talking Heads song, mm-hmm. water flowing underground. It's like, what am I doing with my life? Where am I? And I just thought, wow, this is a nightmare. You know, what am I doing? And I went home and I wrote down a life goal list, and I wrote down some other stuff that's translated into this book. And in the life goal, I said, listen, I want to become the greatest poker player of all time. I'm going to think big. I want to write a New York Times bestseller. I want to meet and marry an amazing woman. I want a beautiful place to live, a house. I want a beautiful car. Well, most of those goals I hit within a year, year and a half. And then, of course, the New York Times bestseller came in 2004 with Play Poker Like the Pros. And so that moment, I wanted to share with people what I figured out. And beyond that, and so yeah, I just have all these lessons that I've kind of been working on. And so, you know, one quick chapter in the book is to write down your life goals. Write down your life goals is a chapter. Another chapter is write down your yearly goals and tape them to your bathroom mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Those life goals should feed, the yearly goals should feed into your life goals. But now it's on your bathroom mirror. So that's two chapters. Write down your life goals. Write down your yearly goals. Another chapter.
There's another one.
Write down your list of blessings and tape that to your bathroom mirror.
There you go.
And so stuff I've been doing my whole life. So imagine this, John. You're brushing your teeth in the morning, and there's a list of goals that informs your day, but there's also a list of blessings. So you're leaving the house happy because you're aware of those blessings, and you see them on an unconscious level or a conscious level sometimes. And, you know, and so, you know, I just thought this has had such a profoundly positive influence on my life that I'm going to, you know, talk about these. And the other chapter that I was mentioning is, you know, the opening the doors chapter. That's four chapters right there. And so it's very simple. This book fits in your back pocket. I sent it to Sheryl Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook. She started her own movement, Lean In, and she's amazing, and she loved it. And she said, I'm so happy to support this. She gave me an amazing blurb. I sent the book to Tony Robbins, and Tony's like, I love this, and he gave me an amazing blurb. And then I sent it to Draymond Green, because I thought it would be fun to, I just love him. And he sent me a nice blurb, and here we are.
Well, where you are now is you've got life goals. You've got yearly goals. You count your blessings, and you pay attention. You have a positive attitude. Phil, one of the chapters in this book is fascinating to me because it is called Honor Your Code. And it strikes me what you've already talked about, a good part of that, but it's not just simply those three words. They stand for something. What do they stand for?
Well, Honor Your Code is, you know, I love this chapter because what I'm really talking about is how to have maximum entitlement. Now, entitlement's a scary word today, you know, and has negative connotations. And, you know, when doing other interviews for this book, the interviewers are always like, entitlement? But I think if you want to do something great in life, you need to have great entitlement. And I watched poker players in position to win millions of dollars and win world championships just suddenly fade, just give it away. And I was like, why is this happening? And I come to find out that some of these guys are alcoholics. Some of them are bad to their family. Some of them, they're not really living by any code, and therefore they don't have a large sense of entitlement. So I developed a theory that, you know, if you want to become great, you have to have a code, especially in a place where you could sabotage yourself. Now, some CEOs don't need a code necessarily because when they come up with their stupid ideas, the board shoots them down right away. But for people that have full control of their lives, this is very important. And so, you know, and so I'm not preaching ethics or morals. I'm preaching to honor your code, whatever that is. So for me, not cheating on my wife is part of my code. And so in 29 years, that's never happened. And I'm afraid if I ever did make a mistake, it would cost me everything. It would cost me a lot of my abilities and a lot of my entitlement. You know, when I'm sitting down looking at winning world championship, you know, number 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 or 14, a historic number, I don't hesitate because I've raised $50 million emceeing charity poker tournaments. I have never cheated on my wife. I have been a really good father and a really good husband. And so I kind of think, why not me? And so, again, I'm not talking about, so I think the person listening has to say to themselves, what is my code? Now, you know your code. You don't even have to write this one down. You know your code. And then you have to stick to your code. And, you know, there may be a process that I don't talk about in the book where you have to go back and forgive yourself for some mistakes you've made in the past. But if you're going to do that, I think that's a good move to do. It's good to address that and understand I want to honor my code because I want to have a maximum sense of entitlement. I don't want to sabotage myself.
The last thing that you talk about that we haven't talked about, but I think it's potent, it's very important, and I've seen it in my own life, and that is give up on hate. Hate gets you nowhere. Hate hurts you. And you talk about that extensively in your book, and why don't you fill in the blanks on that?
Well, the name of the chapter is Hate Hurts You. And so when I was studying Buddhism at Esalen with the Lama Suryadas, and my wife, you know, said, hey, this is how I want to spend my vacation. I'm like, honey, we have a week off. Let's go to Hawaii. She's like, no, we're going to go study Buddhism. Huh? Okay, honey, that's where we're going.
Let's go.
And so, you know, so that's what we did. And, you know, that was a very enlightening week for me. And part of that was, you know, was learning about how hate affects the person that holds the hate in their heart, not the actual person. You listener right now, who's ever listening to this, I want you to imagine the person that you hate the most or dislike the most. Got them in your mind? Fine. That person's not thinking about you right now. So what good is you hating them doing for you? And so, you know, I talk about a story where a poker player who I was staking, I had $28,000 on a site, and $14,000, he'd won so much money, $14,000 was his. He stole the $28,000 from me. We figured it out, and this was on a Monday, and I just was furious. What is going on here? I put food on the guy's family's table. I sent him money so he could buy food. I'm staking him in, you know, in a high-stakes poker game so he can win a lot of money. And what does he do? He steals $28,000 from me. $14,000 was his money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, within an hour, I'm like, okay, Phil, you just studied, you learned about forgiveness, and now is the time where you're going to celebrate your amazing, blessed life. You are going to, this was maybe 2003, 2004, you are going to buy a bottle of Chateau de Kemp and go to the most expensive restaurant you can. And I said, honey, scramble our plans. We're going out for the most expensive dinner we can buy. I told a couple friends, they all said, bury him, put it out on the internet. This guy's reputation is gone, and he deserves it. But I decided to forgive him. And so this was a Monday. Now, Friday, I find myself in Connecticut at Foxwoods, walking into a $10,000 buy-in poker tournament. And I swore the site to secrecy. I swore my friends to secrecy who were still screaming bloody murder. And I remember walking down the hallway on Friday and seeing him. And I shook his hand, but I'd already applied my three-step process towards getting rid of hate for people in my life. And so maybe 70% of my hate was gone. It was still hard to shake his hand.
Yeah.
But instead of spending the next 5 days in Connecticut telling everybody how this guy had slighted me, having every person come up to me, and waging war on the internet with evidence and throwing mud at him, He doesn't have any mud to throw at me. But he would have tried somehow. And so instead of spending all that time battling, I just focused on playing great poker.
And I hope
come
you
to
won.
Find 5 days later, I cashed for $280,000. And I thought, what in the world is going on here? I just hit exactly 10 times, and I said, maybe this forgiveness is even more powerful than I thought it was.
Phil, I'm sorry.
Prologue. He pays me back the $14,000. Okay, it took him a couple of years, number one. And then my wife pointed it out in 2010, 6 years later. She said, this guy defends you to everybody all the time. So I have a lifelong defender, you know,
yeah,
a guy who paid me back in full. I never had to wage war. And basically won a lot of money. And, you know, I have another forgiveness story that I talk about in Poker Brat and Positivity that led to me making $10 million.
All right. Well, and unfortunately, so, we've run out of time. And the people are going to have to read those books to get that additional story. Because I've really enjoyed this, Phil. This is a load of good information and a lot of good conversation. And I thank you very much for joining us. And I wish you luck, not only in the poker world, but also in your other world of writing, and most especially your world of being a good family man. So that's an important thing in our family. Thank you very much,
Phil.
Thank
you, John. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. The name of our program is With Respect, and we're on every Thursday and Sunday. And until then, remember our motto. If you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.